Good morning, church. So very good to see you this morning. The first Sunday of December is always a special Sunday for me and my family because it's our anniversary of being with the McDermott Road congregation. So thank you for putting up with me for 8 years. I'm kind of surprised that you've put up with me this long, and I hope that you put up with me for a long time to come. I tell you every week, but I mean it from the bottom of my heart, I love you. And I'm so incredibly thankful for you and for the relationship that we get to share, that we get to work side by side in this community to be salt and light. Thank you for allowing the Lord to use you the way that you do. Thank you for loving my family the way that you do. I love and appreciate this congregation so much. We're starting a new series. We're talking about hope. And this morning we're going to talk about what hope really is. And I kind of want to start with a strange place to start, I guess. There is something known as cryonic preservation. I really don't know much about this, but I thought it was kind of interesting that there are 500 bodies right now that are frozen in cryonic preservation. When these people died, they had their bodies frozen. There are 4,000 people in addition to that that are waiting for this process to happen to them, that when they die, their bodies will be frozen, hoping that someday there will be technology that will bring them back to life. In fact, here's a quote from one of the cryonics companies. It says, "Cryonics offers an alternative to the finality of death. Those who choose cryonic preservation hope to avoid irreversible death and embrace the possibility of a second chance at life." Now, as I read that, I thought, you know what? I mean, there's a lot in common with the hope that I have. I also hope to avoid irreversible death, don't you? I hope to avoid irreversible death. I hope that there will be a resurrection. I hope that I will embrace the possibility of a second chance at life. But I would argue that the people that have invested their hope in this are doing so without any proof. Without any reason. There is nothing that they can point to and say, see, this has happened before. This can happen again. And so I'm hoping that this will happen for me. But it is a hope, isn't it? It's a hope that someday technology will advance to save them. That technology will advance to fix their problems. That technology will give them a second chance at life. See, I bring this up because The question isn't, do you have hope? That's the next slide. Do you have hope? But rather, what is the object of your hope? These people have hope. They are hoping in technology. They are hoping in medical advancement. And if a lot of us are real honest, we invest a lot of hope in science and technology and advancement, hoping that somehow that technology will fix all of our problems, cure all of our diseases, make all the bad stuff and inconvenient stuff and painful stuff go away. People hope in something. The question is, in what are you hoping? What is the object of your hope? A lot of people hope in government, don't they? A lot of people invest their hope in government, in political leaders, in political policies, in political ideologies, and they hope that these politics, that these leaders, that these parties, that these groups, that these countries will solve their problems, fix what ails them, make everything okay. Everybody hopes. The question is, in what do you hope? A lot of us, if we're honest, we hope in ourselves. We have a lot of self-confidence. We hope in our wealth or our brilliance or our athleticism or our strength or our whatever. We hope sometimes in our goodness. We call that self-righteousness. Everyone hopes. The question is, what is the object of your hope? You have hope. You are hoping in something or someone. The question is, what is the object of your hope? Is it technology? Is it advancement? Is it government? Is it politics? Is it you? Or is your hope the Lord? Is he the object of your hope? I want us to think through what that might look like. If you have your Bible, Psalm chapter 16, Psalm 16, and listen to what David says and how it applies to our life and the way that we hope. David says this, "Preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good apart from you." See, hope has a positive side and a negative side. The negative side is preservation. It's admitting that there are bad things in the world. There are bad things in my life. There are bad things that I'm going through. There are painful things that I'm going through. And hope trusts in God to preserve us, to protect us from the bad things. To say, God, I'm trusting in you. You are my hope. I am not my hope. The government is not my hope. Technology is not my hope. You are my hope. You are my hope to protect me and preserve me. But there's also the positive side of it as well, the providing side of it. I trust that you are the one who is going to provide me with what I need. Apart from you, I have no good. I have no good apart from you. Everything good that I have, everything good that I receive comes from you. Even if you use someone else or something else to bring it to me, I know that you are the source. You are the source of all that is good. And so I hope in no one else. I trust in no one else. I take refuge in no one else. No one else is my fortress. No one else is my rock. You are my hope. You are my hope. What would that look like to really live that way? To really live this way, that in the midst of life's storms, we say, God is my refuge. God is the object of my hope. Look at verse 3. As for the saints in the land, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. The sorrows of those who run after another god shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out or take their names on my lips. See, hope is best done together, isn't it? It is best to hope together. In fact, we do hope together. You will and do and have found people to hope with. We have this tendency to gather together with people who share our hopes. And you've gathered around people that share your hopes. If you hope in this, or you hope in that, or you hope in this other thing, you've gathered around yourself people that share your hopes. And you have a tendency, we have a tendency to push people away from us who don't share our hopes, don't we? And David says, my friends, my heroes are the saints. That just means the holy ones, the people that belong to God, the separated people, the people that have been set apart for a special purpose, God's special people. Those are my friends. Those are the excellent ones. Those are the ones in whom I delight. They're the only people in whom I delight because they share the same hope. They hope in the one in whom I hope. They don't put their trust in other gods. And these people who put their trust in other gods, their sorrows will multiply. They just don't know it yet. They will be sorry because their hope is misplaced. And that's the thing with all of our false hopes, isn't it? I mean, all of our false hopes, they make big promises. There are people, again, that are counting on technology somehow getting to the point that it brings them back to life. And I hate to tell them, but they will be disappointed because technology is a false hope. Oh, it can do some cool things. It can give you some good things. But if you put your hope in it, you will be disappointed. Government can do some cool things. But you put your hope in it and you will be disappointed. You can be pretty spectacular. You're awesome, and I think the world of you. But if you put your hope in yourself, your sorrows will be multiplied. If you put your hope in anything but the Lord, your sorrows will be multiplied. Gather around yourself. And that's what we're doing this morning, isn't it? We're gathering together with people who share our hope, who reinforce our hope. We're hoping together. Look at verse 5. He says, "The Lord is my chosen portion. The Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. You hold my lot. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance." Again, you are not only my protector and my preserver, you are my provider. Everything good that I have comes from you. Again, even if it comes through another conduit, even if somebody else is the one who hands it to me, it came from God. He is the source of all of my blessings. All of these good things come from Him. But it's not about the gift. It's about the giver. It's not about what God gives you. It's about the fact that God is a generous God. This is a season not only of hope and joy, but a season of gift giving. But all too often, we get so caught up in the gift itself, don't we? It's not about the gift. It's about the giver. It's not about loving that thing that someone gave you. It's about loving the person who gave you that thing. Loyalty to God is not about loving the things that God gives us. Loyalty to God is loving God because He provides. It's not about loving the things that He provides. It's about loving God because He provides. He is our chosen portion. He's my portion. He's my blessing. It's not about the stuff that He gives us. It's about Him and a relationship with Him. It's not about loving His blessings. It's about loving Him because He blesses, because He is a generous God. But so often we get caught up in the things that God gives rather than in God Himself, don't we? So then our hope, the object of our hope is the stuff. Even if it's salvation. The goal as Christians is not to be so caught up in salvation for salvation's sake. The goal of salvation is reconciliation with God and with each other. It is the God who gives us that. But so often we only are loyal to God as a means to an end. But the psalmist says, David says, "The Lord is the end. He is the goal. He is my portion. He is my inheritance. He's my chosen portion. He's what I want." Ask yourself that. Do you pray to God and trust in God and hope in God because you love the stuff, the things, the blessings that He gives? Or do you pray to God and trust in God and hope in God because you love God Himself? And if He never gave you another thing, if He never protected you from another danger, would you love Him because of what He's already done and who He's already shown Himself to be? Or do you only love God for the stuff that He gives you? David says, "He is my chosen portion." It's not about the stuff. It's about the God who gives them to us. Verse 7, he says, "I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. In the night also my heart instructs me. I have set the Lord always before me because He is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken." This whole year we've been talking about loving loyalty, and our subtitle has been Unshakable Commitment in Response to Unmerited Favor. Unshakable commitment in response to unmerited favor. God has given us unmerited favor. He has given us grace and mercy and love and blessings that we didn't deserve. And so in response to that, we say, our commitment to you, God, is unshakable. I will not be shaken. I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know what's going to happen in my life. I don't know what's going to happen to me personally. I don't know what's going to happen to my family. But David says, I will not be shaken. My confidence in you, my commitment to you, my loyalty to you, my allegiance to you will not be shaken. Why? Because of who you've already proven yourself to be. You've counseled me. You've gone before me. You've stood beside me. Because of your proven character, hasn't God proven himself? I mean, on a grand scale, for sure, hasn't he proven himself? He has proven who he is, that God is a keeper of promises, that God does not abandon his people, that God does what he says he's going to do, that God is reliable, that God is faithful, that God is trustworthy, that God is loyal. Even when we haven't been, God is loyal to his people. God has proven his character to us. And chances are he's proven himself even in your life. So hope in him. Trust in him. Be loyal to him. Have an unshakable commitment to him because of what he has proven himself to be, because of who he has proven himself to be. Look at verse 9. Therefore, my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, the realm of the dead. You will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. Now, the most plain reading of this text is that David is confident, you won't let me die. You won't let me die. You will not abandon my soul to the realm of the dead. You will not let my body see corruption. And over again, God did exactly that for David, didn't he? Against the bear and the lion when he was just a boy, shepherd. He did that against Goliath. He did that against Saul and the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites. Against his son Absalom, over and over again, God proved to David, I will not abandon your soul to Sheol. I will not let you see corruption. Over and over again, God rescued and saved David from death. But ultimately, David did die. He did die. But in the New Testament, this passage takes on a prophetic meaning. Look at Acts chapter 2, verse 29. This is on the day of Pentecost. The Apostle Peter is quoting from Psalm 16, and he's showing us how this passage takes on a prophetic meaning. He says, "Fellow Israelites, I can tell you confidently that the patriarch David died, and he was buried, and his tomb is here to this day." In other words, his flesh did see corruption. But he was a prophet. And he knew that God had promised him on oath that he would place one of his descendants, one of David's descendants, on his throne. Seeing what was to come, he spoke of the resurrection of the Messiah, that he was not abandoned to the realm of the dead. The Messiah was not abandoned to the realm of the dead, nor did his body, the body of the Messiah, see decay. God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of it. Now, what was true of David in a limited sense, over and over again, in a limited sense, God rescued David over and over and over again from death, is true of Jesus in an ultimate sense, right? And Peter says that David is looking forward into the future, knowing that God is ultimately going to bring one of his descendants to the throne. And who's that? Jesus. Jesus is going to reign on the throne of his father David, and God will not abandon his soul to the realm of the dead or let his body see corruption. And that's exactly what happened, isn't it? God raised Jesus from the dead. Only 3 days in the grave, his body did not see corruption. God rescued Jesus from the dead. But not only does Jesus infuse more meaning into this passage, because what was true of David in a limited sense is true of Jesus in an ultimate sense, it also becomes true because of Jesus for you and for me. Look back again, Psalm 16, verse 10. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption. Now we can pray this psalm with a whole new meaning because of Jesus. Not only does God rescue us day in and day out and preserve us and do good things for us, that's not where our ultimate hope is it? Whatever problem that you're dealing with right now, this limited problem, God may or may not answer that prayer the way that you want Him to. But we know, ultimately, because of Jesus, God will not abandon your soul to the realm of the dead. God will raise you up. God will give you a brand new body that will never see corruption. God will rescue you from death and disease and decay. What God did for Jesus, God will do for you. Why? Because that's the kind of God that we serve, and that's why we hope in Him. It isn't just because of what He did for David. It's for what He did for David's descendant, Jesus. And now because of Jesus, what He promises to do for all of us. Now we can have that same kind of hope, an even bigger hope, an even fuller hope, an even more ultimate hope that whatever it is that we're going through, God is ultimately, one day, on the day of resurrection, going to fix it all. Look at verse 11 of Psalm 16. You make known to me the path of life. There is only one path of life. There is only one person who can show it to you. There is only one who can lead you on that path of life. And in your presence, there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Do you see over and over again, not just in this psalm, but in all the psalms, your, it's about you. See, hope doesn't always know how or when. It just knows who. Who? You. You make known to me the path of life. Your presence, in your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. I don't know what God is going to do in this situation or in the next situation that's coming up for you, but I know that God is the only one in whom we are right to place our trust and to place our hope, because ultimately He will make everything right. He will fix every problem. He will wipe away every tear from our eyes. Biblical hope, I think biblical hope has at least three parts. Here are three things that we do when we hope in the Lord. Here are three things, three parts of biblical hope. Number one, acknowledge the present reality. Biblical hope acknowledges the present reality. Biblical hope is not wishful thinking. It's not optimism. It's not just saying, oh, well, it's not really as bad as it seems. Read through the Psalms, and David will teach you sometimes things are even worse than they seem. And biblical hope acknowledges the present reality. It says, God, this hurts. I don't think this is fair. I have no idea why I'm going through this. Why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to her? Why is this happening to him? Why am I going through this? How long am I going to go through this? How's this going to end? What's going to happen next? Biblical hope is able to acknowledge the present reality. Why? Because hope is for people with problems. Hope is for people with problems. If you don't have problems, you can't have hope. Hope is for people who have problems and who can admit, this is bad. This hurts. This scares me. I don't like this situation. So biblical hope acknowledges the present reality. And then number two, it appreciates God's proven character. It appreciates what God has done. David says, "You are my refuge. I have no good apart from you." Not just for what God has done for you, but for what God has done for his people. Hasn't he proven himself? Over and over and over and over again, that God always keeps his promises, that God is trustworthy, that God is faithful, that God is loyal. God always does what he says he is going to do. He has proven his character. And so hope is about acknowledging where we are, appreciating what has happened in the past, appreciating the character that God has proven himself to have, and then number three, anticipates God being who he has promised to be. So hope looks back at the past and says, who has God proven himself to be? What sort of character has God proven that he has? And then hope looks forward to the future and anticipates God being who he has promised to be, which is why David could say things like, you will preserve me, you will not abandon me. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. It's why David could look forward and say, someday you are going to bring a Messiah to the throne. Someday you're going to bring my descendant to the throne, and you're not going to abandon his soul to Sheol. You're not going to abandon his soul to the afterlife. You're not going to let his flesh see decay. You're going to raise him up. Why? Because David knew the character of God. And knew that God always keeps his promises. And God is going to make everything okay. Hope acknowledges the present reality. Hope appreciates the proven character of God. And hope anticipates God being who he has promised to be. Now, God hasn't promised all the things we try to hold him to sometimes. But here's what hope does. Again, hope doesn't always know how or when. It just knows who. Hope doesn't always know how. God, I don't know. I don't know how you're going to fix this. I don't know whether or not you are going to immediately fix this, or whether this situation itself will, at least for a time, end in tragedy and pain. I don't know how. And I don't know when. I don't know when you're going to show up. I don't know when you're going to fix these things. I don't know when you're going to do something about this. But I know who. I know who you are. I know what kind of a God you are. I know the kind of promises that you've made. And I know that ultimately you are going to raise every single one of your people from the dead. I know that you are going to rescue everyone, that you will not abandon even a single one of your people to the realm of the dead. I know that you will transform all of us so that our new bodies will never see corruption. How do you know that, Wes? How do you know that God will do those things? Because he's already started. Those people that put all of their hope in cryogenics, they're putting their hope in something that is completely unproven. But when you put your hope in the resurrection of Jesus, in the future resurrection of the dead, you're putting your hope in something that's already begun. For hundreds of years, God's people waited. They waited in hope, saying, God, I don't know when, and I don't know how, but I know who. I know who you are, and I know that you will keep your promises. And he did. He sent Jesus to reign on the throne. He raised Jesus from the dead. The resurrection has already begun. And so now, God's people once again find ourselves waiting for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I don't know how much longer we have to wait. I don't know how God is going to fix whatever problems that you're dealing with. I don't know when God is going to fix all of those problems. But I know who. I know who he is. I know who he has proven himself to be. And I know that one day he will undo all of the evil that has been done. He will raise
all of his people from the grave. There will be no more death. There will be no more disease. There will be no more destruction. There will be no more hatred. There will be no more bitterness. There will be no more racism. There will be no more injustice. There will be no more division. God will fix everything that's broken. I don't know how. I don't know when. But I know who. That's what hope is about. We are the people who wait in hope. And we are able to have that hope because of what Jesus has already done. Because Jesus has brought us into the family. So now we can sing the psalm of Psalm 16. We can sing this psalm with whole new meaning and have a whole new hope because of what Jesus has done for us. And maybe there's somebody here this morning and you're ready to lose yourself in Jesus, to be buried with Jesus in baptism, to commit yourself, your loyalty, your allegiance, your trust, your hope to him, and to say to King Jesus, you are my only hope. Or maybe you've already made that commitment. You've already been baptized and you need to recommit yourself to him. Because along the way, our hope gets divided, doesn't it? And we start trying to hedge our bets and putting our hope in lots of different places, in lots of different things, in lots of different people. And sometimes we need to be reminded to recommit our hope to the Lord. Or maybe you're just dealing with a lot right now. And maybe right now is just an opportunity for you to acknowledge the present reality and all the pain that goes with it. And maybe you just need to surround yourself with people who will hope with you. Our shepherds would love to hope with you and pray with you and comfort you and encourage you. Or we as a congregation would love to do that. So feel free, please come forward as together we stand, sing this song.